I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know, the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS, .com/thrive for 20% off your first order. Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
The quick story of this podcast is I decided to do this because I am I'm quite a Frasier fan, or as one of my guests called me, a craniac. So that was Josh Gondelman, who's a comedian. He actually writes for Last Week Tonight. So he was a guest, and his wife is named Maris. So we talked about that for a long time.
There is a real Maris. There is an actual Maris after whom the character was named. A good friend of David Lee.
Really?
Yes.
I had no idea.
She is an actress. Her name is Maris. Well, I should know if I should tell you her last name. I don't want her besieged on by craniacs on Facebook. Her name is Maris Clement. She's an actress. She's a delightful woman. She was in the original Broadway cast of On the 20th Century, among other things. And she and David were theater buddies together. From way back, and he named the offstage character after her. We would frequently name characters after the writers. There's Mrs. Richmond, who is the woman in
Mrs. Richmond.
She was, of course, Jeff Richmond, the writer. The actress who played her and Harriet Harris both were in my wedding.
Wow.
But other characters, I mean, everybody, if you wrote a script and you had to name an offstage character, people frequently would name them after high school friends, so your friend could watch Frasier and hear their name on it. And I would do that all the time. If you just needed a name out of nowhere, why not make it a shout out to a friend?
Oh, for sure. Yes. I noticed that I've done that before when I've been writing a script because the names need to come from somewhere. Welcome to I'm Listening. This is a Frasier fan podcast that explores themes and moments and topics from the show, one of my favorite shows. So we usually have a special guest, and today is no different, except it's a very, very special guest that we have today. So I am actually joined by one of the writers and, correct me if I'm wrong, executive producers of the show, Frasier. Please welcome Joe Keenan to the podcast. Hello, Joe. How are you?
Hello, Anita. I'm delighted that you want to talk to me. Executive producer was my title by the end of the show that I started, it was my first job, so I started as an executive story editor. And usually the way it works in a show is that, you know, when people are called back to another season, they tend to get a title bump each year, eventually rising to the level of executive producer. You'll notice when you see credits that if a show's been on a long time, everybody's an executive producer because they've all been doing it for a long time.
I had no idea. Do you know that, I don't know if you've ever Wikipedia'd yourself, but when I was looking at episodes that you wrote, there was a note under the episode, The Matchmaker, that said, it is noteworthy in being Joe Keenan's first episode produced on the show after he became a regular writer and eventually executive producer on the show. And I was aware that it won a GLAAD award.
Yeah. Well, first of all, as for Googling myself, I don't know what sort of vain creature you take me for. I've never done that. actually, it was, yes, it was the first. You'll notice the tricky wording there. It was the first episode that was produced by the show. The way that worked was that and toward the end of season one, I had done a pilot at Paramount, which was my first TV script ever produced, the pilot. And when that didn't go, there was possible interest in my joining Frasier for the second season. And I was invited to write a script as an audition. And that script that I wrote during the first season was eventually done. It was Botched Language of Cranes, which was the second one produced. So The Matchmaker was actually my second script. It was the first one that I wrote after I'd actually joined the staff and was in the room and working with people. I'd written the other one back in New York on my own. But it was the first one produced. Yes.
Wow. I'm curious, do you have a favorite episode that you did write of all of the episodes?
That's always a hard one. I mean, I had a special soft spot, you know, for the farces, and I probably of the farces I wrote, my favorite may have been Out With Dad, just for the reason that of all of them, I mean, they're all funny and they're all convoluted and misunderstandings and such, but that one had a little bit more unexpected heart than the other ones. That wound up in a kind of sweet place that you didn't see coming. And sweet is, you know, make no mistake, sweet is not what you're aiming for with the farce. You're aiming for, you know, maximum confusion and escalating comedy finally erupting, and, you know, and in the last moment, everybody, you know, realizes what they've gotten wrong or the lie is revealed. But that one is the only one where the basis of the farce is people trying to help each other. Farce often begins, you know, there are two kinds of farce, I think. One is the farce of misperception, where everybody just the wrong end of the stick. And Matchmaker was a farce of misperception, and the Ski Lodge was a farce of misperception, where everybody just got it wrong. And then there are farces of deception, where people, for whatever purpose, tell a lie to somebody. And it's usually a polite or a social lie, the ramifications of which you don't think you'll have to deal with momentarily. But what ultimately happens is the situation extends past the point where you thought it would, and now you're stuck with this lie that you can't climb down from. And it often requires telling other lies, and the situation builds and gets more complicated, and your predicament gets bigger. So, but the lie told in Out With Dad was Martin, you know, letting a woman think he was gay. That was not to ruin Frasier's romantic chances with his daughter. He's not trying to do anything but avoid hurting this woman's feelings, because that would damage Frasier's chance of, you know, of kindling a romance with the daughter. So to spare her feelings, he doesn't even tell the lie, by the way. She jumps to that conclusion and he goes with it. But having let her think he's gay, everything else, you know, proceeds from that deception. But, you know, it's a very, very sweet show in the way it ends, and the way Martin winds up unexpectedly bonding with this middle-aged, you know, homosexual guy, the uncle he set up on a date with. So I like it just a skosh better, as Frasier would say, for that reason.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's definitely some extra heart in that episode. And, you know, I feel like, I don't know, I think it depends on the person. But for me, you know, depending on it, at least with Frasier, it's a show that I really loved, because I also, one part of it that I do relate to, because for me, the show is often an escape for me in a way, because most of the show is not necessarily things that I can relate to as a, you know, a Latina woman, but like it's the one thing that I do relate to is the relationship that Frasier has with his dad. I'm very close to my dad. So often, as I've talked about with other guests, you know, the beauty of, at least for me, my favorite comedies, including Frasier, is this idea that's pretty unrealistic in real life, which is that you find these people, whether it be you're a healthcare worker, you're a radio producer, and because it's not real life, you end up spending the next 11 years together in close quarters. Even though, like, another example would be King of Queens, for example, because I think about my dad and the fact that I'd love to live closer to him. So I love the idea of either living with him, like Frasier does with his dad, or in the garage, like Kevin James's father-in-law does with his father-in-law. So that's part of the reason I do really love Frasier, is that sort of genuine, you know, granted they are so different, the actual bond that lies with Frasier and Niles and Martin. So I really did like that episode. But while we're still talking about farce, so as you were describing it, I mean, you know, truth be told, until I had Anthony Oliveira, who I believe you have at least spoken to on Twitter.
Yes, we have gone back and forth on Twitter.
I'm a big fan of his. I mean, I end up talking about the episode The Ski Lodge a lot because it is, I would say, my favorite episode of the entire show. And for me, you know, I think about the structure of that show. And now that I finally have you here with me, I'm very curious about, I mean, granted, the word farce is part of that episode. So I am curious. I know it's been a while, but maybe even not just that episode, but Out with Dad too. Anything where there is this sort of escalating situation that doesn't sort of sort itself out until the end. Do you have like a process that you would go through in terms of structurally when you were writing an episode like this with farce?
Well, the main thing you have to remember with farce is that you're trying to get to a place of really big, broad absurdity and high comedy, and it only works if you get there through very small and scrupulously logical steps. The minute, you know, mm-hmm. people don't buy something, the whole plate collapses. You have to absolutely be able to, you know, believe every step along the way, or you start to feel that the writers and the actors are just pulling strings and trying to put one. And as soon as anybody says, oh my God, that would never happen, why on earth would he say or do that when the logical thing would be to do this and clear it up immediately? There always has to be a reason why that hasn't happened. I mean, even in going about, to veer off the Sea Lodge for a second, even going about Out with Dad, I knew that the comedy would depend upon, you know, the perception that Martin was gay, and that they would bring back this date for him. And Martin would not at first realize that this guy who showed up with Frasier's date, her uncle, was meant to be a date for him. But I thought, well, why do they think Martin's gay? And I thought, well, you know, he's trying to avoid hurting the feelings of the mother. And so does he tell her he's gay? And I thought, no, Martin wouldn't do that. That would be a false moment. Right. Martin would come up with that. So what happens is that he's left with this woman that he's inadvertently waved at. He was waving to the daughter to get her attention. Mom thought the wave was for her. And now she's flirting with him at intermission. And he's feeling very uncomfortable because he's not interested in a high-class opera-loving dame like her. And he's trying to make small talk, and in making the small talk, he quotes Frasier's line about the soprano playing Gilda in the production of Rigoletto being, she's no Renata Tebaldi. And Martin, at a loss for something to say, quotes it. And then when she says, you know, I have tickets for another opera next week, and he suddenly goes all bashful and awkward. He tries to explain, says, it's, you know, it's not you, it's just you see. And she says, you're gay. And he says, hurting her feelings, we'll go with that. And she says, well, I thought you might be, how many straight men remember who Bernardo Spalding was? And so logically quoting Frasier in an awkward situation has led to a misperception, which he's gone with because it's the easier route, rather than saying, no, I'm straight, I just don't like you. You know, he's done what he thinks, you know, is a graceful exit from an awkward situation, and then the entire second act is the ramifications of it. So that, I mean, that's an example of just trying to, you know, while you're plotting something, say, oh, she has to think that, but why would she? And Martin could say it, but Martin wouldn't say it. So how did it happen? So plus, it's always addressing one little logical problem. Like the genesis of the ski lodge was, you know, really kind of unique in that I went, it was right before Christmas, and we were trying to, you know, break a story to come back with, and we were said, well, let's do, we haven't done a cabin show in a while, where they all go off, what would be a variation on a cabin show that we haven't done before? Mm-hmm. And the minute we got, you know, the idea of, you know, Daphne bringing a girl that Fraser was chasing, and there's, you know, a handsome French ski instructor, just in the first, you know, mm-hmm. 5 minutes of talking about it, I suddenly thought, huh, so Fraser is chasing Daphne's friend Annie. Annie is chasing Niles. Niles is, as always, chasing Daphne. Daphne is chasing the handsome ski instructor, and the handsome ski instructor, and here's a surprise, chasing Niles. And I said, well, this situation is very funny as long as nobody realizes who's romancing them, and at the same time is given an incorrect signal that the person they're interested in them back. And so you just had to answer questions. Why do they all think that? How do they get the wrong end of the stick? And then the idea of Martin, you know, having his ears clogged up in the mountains, and the imagining things that gave everybody, him hearing things only halfway and making responses
for sure
that sent everybody off on the wrong track. Even at that, you know, making them, Chris Lloyd had a wonderful idea. We say, what is going to make everybody, once they've all gone to their rooms, summon the courage, you know, to start knocking on doors and, you know, and proffering sex to the object of their desire. And two things about that. One was Mia Martin's famous rom got everybody just a little loose and uninhibited. But he also, you know, maybe he should say something about your regrets in life, or about the things you, not about the things you do, but the things you don't do. So everybody, is put in everybody's head of, you know, how I feel at the end of this weekend if I lost the courage to make my move, and damn it, I'm going to. And that's the end of it. But it was a great idea for Chris that final push for everybody to say, good, I'm going for it, you know, came out of something that was just a little bit emotional.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, there's just even like teeny tiny things about that episode. Like one thing that comes to mind is even just a line at the very end that's so funny. And I thought, is this, so the instructor's name is Guy.
Yeah.
And just a line that just made me laugh at the end is, I'm not gay, Guy. Yeah. And I thought, I've you know, watched the episode so many times. I'm like, when did you decide that his name should be Guy? Because you know, you had to write that line with that name in mind. I mean, there's just all these, like, it feels like a mathematical equation to me, the comedy.
It's absolutely the mathiest of all the farces we did. There were more misunderstandings than, yeah, ricocheting off the walls in that one. Actually, my two favorite lines from that are when Guy bursts in and finds Fraser in bed and says, you are not the crane I want. He says, you're not even the sex I want. When Andy says, so it's a threesome you want, but I don't do those anymore.
Now, you doing a British accent brings me to a question I have for you, which is, number one, I like your British accent. Sounds like you've spent some time there. I say that because I think that you mentioned in a tweet when I was promoting Anthony's episode, I feel like you mentioned that you perhaps either visited or lived in England. Is that incorrect? Correct?
I visited only once and far too briefly, and was a British film producer who'd acquired the rights to my novel and, you know, was trying to set it up over there. So I went there. Actually, that visit, you know, prompted something that's of interest vis-a-vis Fraser and Niles and the whole issue of male metrosexual men who were easily perceived. But I was put up with this very posh English doctor named Dr. Johnny Gaynor, and I completely took the man to be gay. He was so put together, so every single little posh detail was perfect, and the conversation was all about Freddie Ashton and the Royal Ballet. And as we were having lunch, this woman showed up, this very attractive, you know, blonde woman, a real, Annie lookalike, very sexy. And she just, came by and she disappeared into the kitchen and he immediately became, a sniggling straight character out of a Ray Cooney sex star saying, "Not bad, huh? Not bad." Oh my God. I completely took, the man to be gay, but he's, straight and absurdly proud of his two young girlfriends.
Wow.
So that whenever people would say, "Oh, well, I'm sure you're not gay," I mean, you've clearly never been to London because, the old joke of, a homosexual and an Englishman being a distinction without a difference.
Well, that does make me think about the fact that, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the episode, The Matchmaker, was the first episode before several other ones came along of, at least one Crane being mistaken for gay. So did any of that come from sort of you having that trip and sort of looking at, stereotypes around, gay stereotypes or stereotypes around metrosexuals?
Not really. It was certainly always, clear from the get-go that Frasier and Niles and their fussiness and their devotion to fashion and grooming and high culture were people who would signify as gay to a lot of people, who didn't know them and just went off the surface clues. The idea for The Matchmaker came out of, we were looking for an episode based on Daphne dating Frasier's boss. He said, "What if Frasier brought his boss home to dinner and he took a shine to Daphne?" And that one might be an interesting comic situation to explore, where his employee is dating his boss. And we thought, well, that's funny, but we started batting it around and the idea just wasn't going anywhere, as happens, four times out of five, you get an idea and you just can't develop it to your satisfaction. And it's like, what would be funny about that dinner? And I just said, "Oh, well, maybe it's funny scene if you think he's on a date with Frasier." And the entire story developed from that. It's like, well, why does he think Frasier's gay? Again, you're back to farce plotting. We have to, he takes Frasier to be gay, because they start having that conversation and they're talking about London and they're talking about fashion and they're talking things that signify, Frasier is gay to him. And we have, and he in turn is, to flip the stereotype on its side, on its back. Frasier never assumes that he is gay because he's not remotely, nothing about him signals he's just like Frasier. So he's gay. He's not remotely, effeminate or anything that would clearly signal gay to Frasier. So Frasier assumes he's straight. He assumes Frasier is gay. And when we find out, we have to find out that he's gay. Who does he talk to? He talks to Roz. Why doesn't Roz correct him? Because Frasier has just insulted her. Like, you have to go back and insert the insult. So that when we get the information, there's a reason for Roz not to clear it up. It's like, well, why wouldn't Roz just say, "Oh, actually, Frasier's not, not gay." Frasier, as he so often does, insults her, and this time she says, "Screw him. Let him find out in his own time if he's on a date."
I mean, in terms of like the writing that I do, I'm not generally writing screenplays. So I often always think about how much from real life goes into a script. So I think in my head, I had created this like grand idea, perhaps, because you do like in the episode the boss, he mentions he had left England and had like gotten out of a bad relationship or something. So in my head, I thought, I wonder if Joe had some sort of like torrid affair in London, and that's what brought all of this whole thing on. It sounds like you going there did have an effect, though, just in terms of the thought process.
It was a funny surprise to me at the time that guy wasn't gay, but I only thought about it in later years when the whole issue of, American metrosexuals, which were pretty new, and actually it's not a word anybody says anymore, is it? Metrosexuals. It had its 10-year vogue and has gracefully retired from the language. But it, I would often think about that guy when people would say, "Well, you know, aren't Frasier and Niles clearly gay?"
Yeah, I mean, you know, I started watching Frasier while it was on, so you know, I was. You know, pretty young in 1993. And I didn't even know until I think the show was off the air. I didn't know, you know, how many actors in real life were gay. I didn't know that David Hyde Pierce was gay. I didn't even think about, like, I just didn't even think about the writing and the treatment of storylines until I was much older, because I also grew up watching the show Friends, and it was just very, I don't know, it was interesting to see the difference. I mean, from like the early 90s, what the treatment of a storyline is with gay characters, or you know, the kind of plots, the kind of farcical plots that were in Frasier felt really different than a show like Friends, which was often like, you know, often it was the butt of a joke, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about this before with other guests on your show. And I was not a regular viewer of Friends. I certainly saw the show, but I didn't see enough episodes to have a particular sense of how they treated gay characters. It's interesting to me, when I spent the first year of Frasier as an audience member, I was, you know, living in New York, mm-hmm. and watching the show. And at that time, and only at that time, and only because I'm, you know, a gay man who'd grown up at a time where gay men were used to looking for coded homosexuality, you know, characters who struck us as gay at a period where, you know, where entertainment didn't have that many out gay characters, the characters who were identified as gay. At that time, Niles struck me as a bit codedly gay, partly mm-hmm. because of all the reasons we've discussed, partly because I had met David's partner, Brian, a wonderful, wonderful guy. So I knew that, and I was also struck by the way Niles was a straight man whose romantic feelings were neatly balanced between a beautiful young woman whom he could never have or declare himself to, and a wife who was invisible. And I thought that combination of the unattainable woman and the invisible woman read me that way, again, as an audience member and a gay man used to looking for every coded signal they could find. By the time I got on the show in season two and we started writing, that perception changed very much, partly because in the first season, the Niles' attraction to Daphne was very, you know, fun and mostly played for, you know, for funny beats about his, you know, his crush on her. But as the show developed and the love became such, I mean, it became so much more real because it became such a big part of, you know, the show's great romantic arc was Niles and Daphne. And the more we focused stories on it, and the more David brought his hopeless love for her to, you know, very funny and often very poignant life and, you know, and all the stories that focused on that, the less it seemed to me, and the more absolutely real, you know, not both Niles' heterosexuality and his love for Daphne, you know, came to seem to me and to the audience. I mean, I don't think anyone ever doubted how completely, you know, heartfelt and genuine it was. I think it made it, you know, hard, I think, for them. We got them together at the end of season seven. I think it was very hard to figure out how to navigate the relationship once it stopped being unspoken and they had to be together. It was more delicate to, you know, to keep the comedy. And it, you know, there's a reason all the Jane Austen novels and the lovers, you know, pledging themselves to each other and revealing their feelings, and you know, cause it's tricky to go past that. But I was glad when we came back in season 11 that the pregnancy, you know, brought sort of new wrinkles and conflict and fun into that relationship.
I mean, I actually thought a great episode, you know, once they got together, I thought a really great episode that actually to me addresses sort of the love story or sort of the romanticism of having a love you can't ever attain is when Daphne comes back from, in real life, I believe she had a baby, I think. But when she came back and she tells Niles that, I think, her therapist thinks, you know, perhaps part of the reason she might have gained weight was like this pressure she felt about this relationship and the fact that she thinks Niles has built her up into this person, you know, into this mythical figure. And then, you know, Niles and Frasier like go back into previous scenes from the show, back into his memory to sort of, you know, kind of discuss.
I absolutely saw that episode and I thought it was beautifully handled. They did a lot of wonderful episodes in those years.
One of the things that I truly did love about this show is that love story. It 100%, I would say, for at least a few heartbreaking crushes I've had on different people have definitely come from that idea of like, oh, you know, loving someone from afar is this truly tragically romantic thing. And in the end, somehow it'll work out. And I, you know, I'm curious about, you know, the way that things unfolded in Something Borrowed, Something Blue. I was fully, as a Frasier fan, I was fully satisfied by that reveal. I'm curious about, you know, what thought process went into that being the reveal and just even waiting that long to do it.
The thought process, we had played the near misses, we had played the almost revealed a lot. We decided at the beginning of season 7 that the year would have to build to them declaring and to Daphne sharing it, and that we would get there to that ending through some you know, key milestones along the way. The first and the biggest of which was that back talk episode where Frasier, under the influence of painkillers, getting a massage from Daphne, let it drop that no one crazy about her, and afterwards had no recollection of it. So you know, there's a suddenly you could play Daphne being aware of that at the same time, you know, that she was with somebody else and Niles was gravitating himself, you know, throwing the towel and realizing she's found somebody and I have to move on and find somebody myself, only for it all to come together and at the worst possible moment and at the end of the season. So we mainly decided that because we felt we have jerked the audience's chain long enough. They have been with this. You can only play, you know, is going to happen. No, it's not, so many times before the audience stops being, you know, starts enjoying the tease and starts getting exasperated. And we felt we'd reached that point and that had to be, you know, where the season would end.
For me, it didn't feel like it dragged because I was also, I was very just even impressed with the absurdity and just how things turned out with Maris, just the sort of roller coaster of that marriage. And I mean, I'm glad none of us ended up seeing her, but if you could put in like, and this could be anyone dead or alive, I'm curious, is there any actress that you could ever picture playing Maris?
Any actress you could picture as Maris wouldn't need a role. She'd need medical attention.
That's a good point.
We had made far too many jokes about how impossibly thin she was, that, you know, at a wine club trip, she, you know, got into a vat of grapes, stomped herself into a barefoot frenzy and failed to break even a single grape. She ran away through the snow and I tried to follow her tracks, but of course you can't do those jokes and then possibly try to find a woman who doesn't give the lie to all of them. To me, the most incredibly impressive thing about David's acting, among many, many things, his brilliance and comic timing, was that he was a good enough actor to deliver those jokes about Maris routinely defying the laws of physics and gravity. And at the same time, make you completely believe in the reality of the character and his conflicted, misguided love for her. You know, you used to always wonder, how did that romance begin? At what point, what drew him to her, and what, you know, because she was so emotionally withholding and so capricious and so you know, monstrously, you know, selfish and a funny character. But David knew that if you didn't believe in the emotional reality of the love Niles originally had for Maris and his, you know, hopes that it could be, you know, rekindled, then there'd be no conflict with Daphne. Why wouldn't he just tell Daphne, you know, if he wasn't, you know, truly conflicted emotionally about what he felt about Maris and what he owed to her.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I, you know, this is me just making assumptions, but given the fact that, you know, before Daphne, he is in a relationship with Mel, you know, there's many comparisons to Mel and with Maris, there's comparisons to the dog that he has for a while, with Maris. And I don't know. And then, so Daphne's such a fresh change but he also thinks in his mind for so long that she's just completely unattainable. So part of me wonders if the women that he's with before Daphne are just the women he thinks he deserves, if that makes any sense. That's how I sort of read him, because his taste in women is so vastly different compared to the woman that he ends up with. She's just so, so different. That's how I observed Daphne and Niles.
You have correctly identified a paradox. why would the guy who, you know, who is so you know, keen on relationship with Maris and Mel have Daphne as his true love? You know, she was definitely a character that we rooted for romantically. And I think, you know, I think we were meant to have the sense, and believe me, I haven't, you know, analyzed this, thought about it, a great deal, that part of Niles that has an attraction to a certain kind of, you know, world and a certain kind of, you know, of, you know, elegance and high culture and, you know, and prestige and marvelous people in tuxedos drinking wine, that, you know, that women who, you know, who represented that would never be the entire reason why Niles go for a woman, but membership in the world would definitely trigger a certain part of his brain.
Absolutely. And actually that brings me to, There's an episode that's very late in the game. I think season 11, which is with Patrick Stewart, called
"The Doctor
Is Out." I love that episode, and I also thought, just going from like where Frasier is, you know, in an episode like The Matchmaker, to a different, like, it's, you know, yes, it's a plot where he's mistaken for being gay. But the part that I loved about that episode is that some themes for me that stick out to that show all came together in this episode, specifically being mistaken for being gay, but also desperately wanting to be part of this like elite, like, you know, lifestyle. And the fact that he's just like contemplating that, those choices, like, oh, maybe I can just date him at the end, made me laugh. And I didn't question it because just of, you know, with what you just said, this idea that the both of them are so, you know, they just want to be in this elite, you know, community.
It was more than that. It was, he felt about Alistair the same complete, you know, abject, you know, hero worship that, you know, that a guy would, that a straight guy would feel towards, you know, being with, you know, with Michael Jordan or some, you know, something amazing sports star. He was, you know, absolutely at the pinnacle of everything that Frasier admired. And I was so happy when we came up with that idea early in season 11, because I enjoyed it. I mean, people talk about, you know, the gay farces and the farces of Frasier. You have to remember that in 264 episodes, there were only four farces with a strong gay element to them. Matchmaker out with Dad, The Ski Lodge, and The Doctor Is Out. And that was it. Four out of 264 isn't exactly, you know, a massive area of focus show. People remember that, right. And that's nice because they were kind of, you know, pinnacles of silliness and sexual discomfort and, you know, things that people find funny. But what I started to say was that I was very glad when we came up with that idea, because I thought it would be fun to do another one, but do again what we've already done? What is going to make the story of sexual confusion and Fraser being taken today, what is going to make it different enough from the ones we've already done to justify the story right. again? And what makes it different right. is that, you know, Fraser worships the guy. Fraser, you know, mm-hmm. Fraser is outed by finding himself in a gay bar in Miles North. Again, that's far as, you know, why is Fraser in a gay bar? Because, you know, why is Fraser outed? Fraser is outed because he's in a gay bar. Why is he in a gay bar? He's in a gay bar because he thought, you know, he thought that he saw, you know, the friend of Ron is that he assumes, you know, was gay. He thought that, so he follows him in and he can't find him. Miles leaves him. Why does he look extra specially super gay? Because he split his tennis shorts and had to wear Miles. So he's in a gay bar in right. ridiculously tight little white shorts, you know, waiting for Niles to use the bathroom while bobbing around to the music, you know, and it ends with Miles screaming, for God's sake, take me home. So I've, of course, you know, you've got a funny circumstance which Fraser will be outed on his show by a call the next day saying that Fraser defends his advice, but he's a hypocrite. But then the option of this today is this person, this, you know, this world famous, you know, glamorous, erudite, massively talented, you know, director of opera, whom we see Fraser now fawning over when, in a chance encounter in the first scene. Suddenly that guy is very interested. Suddenly that guy's inviting him to rehearsal, they're palling around. And Fraser, you know, Fraser wants the friendship so bad he can't admit they're dating. The guy assumes that this is a relationship. And the reason Fraser can hang on is for whatever reason, the guy has not made a move. Fraser will ride this train as far as it will take him before he has to admit the truth of, you know, you're not friends. You know, he's dating you whether you know it or not, whether you want to admit it. And even there, I thought, why hasn't he made a move? It doesn't make sense. If he thinks he's dating Fraser, why hasn't he made that clear? And so I wrote a speech for him in the final scene, the opening night of his opera that he's been rehearsing, where he talks about how when I'm doing an opera, I completely devote myself to the job at hand. You know, I know exercise, and not even sex. Well, just ask Fraser here, poor dear patient Fraser. And it's a very funny way to pull a rug out from him and say, yeah, okay, you know, there you are. That's why he hasn't made a move. Yeah. Now it's open tonight, so to speak. So it was nice to do one more the gay farces and make it just different enough to justify it.
Yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, you're absolutely correct in terms of, you know, how many specific episodes there were around that kind of plot. But there's definitely just little things that, you know.
Well, an undercurrent. Yeah. I think there were other moments where they were taken. There was a point where Niles was ring shopping in one of the seasons. I wasn't there for it, but I remember this. They said Niles and Fraser were shopping for a ring for themselves.
No, I remember that. I was actually thinking of an episode where Lilith shows up and she reveals that her, I think, husband or boyfriend left her for another man. And she, you know, she says something like, you know, Stan was looking for somebody more feminine and he found him. And I thought that was really funny. I was like, okay, all right, Mary. I mean, well, there's definitely a lot of the women on that show. Definitely, I would say fall under like, you know, don't mess with me. Like I felt the same way about like Lilith, Bibi, Dr. Nora, which is, I think, a show that, or an episode that you had wrote for?
Yes, I did. I wrote that
yes.
one.
Yes. I'm a big Christine Bransky fan.
That was the only time in Frasier that we based an outside character on a real life person. And it was, of course, Dr. Laura Schlesinger, who was at the time doing, you know, had a radio show and was, you know, full of, she was really just, you know, kind of a disagreeable, truculent, you know, avatar of, you know, old-fashioned, you know, 1950s sexual morality. And we always decided that it would be interesting to do a character like her because she, you know, she intersected so clearly with Fraser's world. She had the same job as him. So somebody coming to the station that would be like that, and Fraser sort of, you know, taking this, you know, woman under his wing and then discovering that he, you know, kind of unleashed a monster.
Yeah.
There was a joke from Matt I loved when, you know, he said his show was so popular that they were considering doing a third hour of it. He was looking for somebody new to sort of carry on the show. He says, a third hour, but I mean, it would be absolutely exhausting for me to do a third hour. And Al said, yes, for you as well, I'm sure.
I really liked sort of the way she ends up sort of getting, well, punished at the end, which is, I don't know if Freudian is the right word, but the fact that, you know, where did her personality come from? It turns out, you know, she has this crazy mother, you know, who's seemingly probably made her, well, called her a whore a lot, but seemingly sort of shaped the kind of advice that she gives out.
Yes. I remember. What I did like about that ending was that it was Fraser trying to rise above his disapproval and his dislike of her, and trying to repair her relationship. That Fraser approached, finds, tracks down mother and brings them together, in the hopes of affecting Rochemont. Sure. And you find out instead that the mother, you know, can't stand her daughter and has only been looking for a chance to, you know, to lay into her again.
Absolutely.
Which was also part of Dr. Laura's lore, that she famously was completely estranged from her mother for reasons that she would not discuss at all on the air. So since she won't discuss them, we'll just have to make up something, won't we?
I was curious about the last episode, Goodnight Seattle, which, by the way, if you don't know this about my podcast, that's how I end every episode, by saying Goodnight Seattle. Does it make any sense? No, because I'm in New York and it's not nighttime. But I was a fan of how you guys of how you wrapped the show up. I'm curious about, you know, when did the decision come in to have him, like, him leaving made a lot of sense to me, but, you know, at what point did, you know, you think, you know what, let's leave things on a bit of a cliffhanger? Was, you know, like, was that intentional? The fact that, you know, you wonder and you don't know.
When we knew, when Chris Hudd and I returned to the show, given the last, and we knew it would be the last show. And it's a very important thing to know that you're doing a final season of the show, because you can sort of bring the series to the conclusion and end with things that the aftermath of which you don't need to deal with. You can give Niles and Daphne a baby without having to do now a season of them being parents and trying to find fresh variations on all the jokes that have been, you know, so many times. But we knew going into it that we wanted to bring all the characters to a culmination that would leave, you know, Fraser feeling that he needed to move on. And the other thing we knew, because that's, you know, the show that, you know, Cheers ended with, you know, because you're taking a leap of, you know, the courage to, you know, go back to Seattle and start a new life with the father he was estranged from and the brother with whom he had a rocky relationship, and being, you know, that far away from his kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a scary thing for Fraser. We thought, well, he should do that again. He should say, you know, everybody here has reached a settled point that Martin would find a wife. So we said, well, who's Martin going to marry? And we came up with the character of Ronnie and Matt, not those stories. And that's, we knew that it would be really exciting and something we hadn't seen before, to see Fraser, so many funny woman of the week, bad meeting stories, to finally feel about a woman the way Miles felt about Daphne. We had never seen Fraser in love. Mm-hmm. We had seen him, his romances were all, who's this wonderful woman? Who's this, all gone by the end of the episode. To see him actually, you know, and experience, you know, the emotion of years. And the tricky, you know, question there was, well, who do we cast?
Right.
He's gone through that. What is going to make the audience feel? And it's not a matter of being able to cast it. Who was the audience going to want to see him with? Who was the audience going to say, yeah, you're right, this is the one. This is the role, and this is the actress we'd be happy to think of Fraser winding up with. And we thought, well, Laura Linney would be fantastic. She's such a good actress, and she, you know, she has, you know, such you know, heart and such, you know, such presence and such warmth. If Frasier fell in love with her, we'd totally be rooting for that.
Right.
And Laura fortunately agreed to do it. And we, you know, it was only about six episodes, second half of the season. But it did, you know, bring him to a place where she had to go, she had to leave and go to another city, and he was going to step off the cliff again and fall over. And we didn't know what happened there, but we were, you know, glad that, you know, everybody was left in a place where, you know, everything he saw when he came back to Seattle had been achieved, and he was the only one still looking, you know, for somebody to share his life with, and he found her and had to follow her.
Yeah. Well, it was a very romantic place to end. Do you ever think, or did you with anyone else from, you know, the writing staff, did any of you wonder, or do you think that they ended up together?
Do I think that they ended up together?
Yeah. Like, does his gamble work?
I never wondered if they got together. I just loved the gesture, and I knew that Frasier would be okay in the end, but I love the uncertainty of it too much to want to even in my mind move past it to, of course, they lived happily ever after.
Well, I actually, so after watching that episode, I did an entire episode of this podcast about Frasier fan fiction, because if you didn't know, there is a whole very vast world of Frasier fan fiction out there. When I had Josh Gondelman on, we went through, there was one particular guy who had started writing Frasier fan fiction while the show was still on, as in, you know, he wrote like an entire spinoff for Roz, for example. So I'm just, before we sort of wrap up, I would just love to run by like two or three of these spinoff ideas to you, because I'm curious if they pique your interest. So this one comes from me that I came up with. It's called Young Martin, and it's basically a gritty crime drama that follows young Martin Crane as a cop solving crimes. And it definitely starts with him meeting his future wife, who also, I forgot, I know they met over a chalk outline, but I forgot what her job was, like a coroner or something, or a psychologist. No, a psychologist.
No, she was a psychologist.
She was a psychologist.
She was probably.
And they met over a chalk outline. So, you know, there's a lot of gritty reboots that seems to be like the trend right now, you know, with like Riverdale, which is a,
but
you know.
That's a prequel is what you're pitching.
Oh yeah, you're right. Fine. It's a gritty prequel.
It's the drama prequel.
It's the drama.
Believe it or not, has been done. Who is the one character in sitcom history who transitioned from a comedy to a drama?
Oh, I'm so bad at this. I honestly already give up. What's the answer?
Lou Grant, Mary Tyler Moore's boss. Lou Grant was on the Mary Tyler Moore show, and there was an hour-long show called Lou Grant, where he was, I believe, working at a newspaper.
Oh. I had no
idea. So
I've
actually played Lou Grant on two series, and the second one was a drama, not a comedy, which is, I think, really the only time this happened.
Wow. Okay. So are you telling me that this is a good idea? Or you're saying it's already been done before, so let's move on to something else.
It's a fun idea. It's actually a little bit of young Sheldon, too. When you go back in time, because you would see Martin and Hester and Frasier and Niles in their formative years.
There you go.
I think that could be fun. Clearly, there's mileage in it. I think young Sheldon's doing well.
You know what? I can't believe that in all of the fan fiction that I combed through and wrote myself, nobody seemed to have come up with a young Sheldon basis, as in like, you know, a Malcolm in the Middle situation, and everyone's like coming of age. The fam, you know, they also live together. That's a show I would watch 100%. You never know. It could happen. Was that ever a conversation ever doing like a reunion?
No, there was always a feeling from the cast, certainly from David Hyde Pierce, that it wasn't a good idea, and that we were very glad to have gotten the show over the finish line. in a way as, you know, as good to search for a properly Fraser, you know, highfalutin word. It was good. We wanted to leave it there. We wanted to leave it there. So I know Niles David Hyde Pierce was considered a bad idea, and we wouldn't want to do it now anyway because we don't have John.
Did you have a favorite character that you did like to write for on the show?
I couldn't really decide. I mean, there were moments where you loved writing all of them. I mean, I always enjoyed writing Niles. I clearly enjoyed writing Bebe Glazer, whom we didn't get to at all.
Oh, I love her.
Bebe, she's a wonderful actress. She's a wonderful character, and she's a very good friend of mine, Harriet Harris, who is just, I just went back east a few weeks ago to see her in a musical.
Oh.
Well, I can give you one Fraser story that you'll never hear anywhere else.
Oh, let's hear it.
Okay, one reveal. The musical theater composer, William Finn, who wrote the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee and Falsettos and A New Brain, among other shows, approached us in season 2 or 3 wanting to write a musical episode of Frasier.
Oh, my.
And he loved the show, and he wanted to write a whole musical episode. And we couldn't go with it because it was so hard getting 24 episodes a year done on our schedule, and a musical one would have been so difficult, you know, to write and to time out. Doing a musical number is so complicated that it takes so much longer to do.
Yeah.
Than a standard episode, you know, in terms of the writing of it, and what if you wrote something and we didn't think it worked, or what if it didn't time out right? We just thought it was so logistically daunting that, you know, we didn't want to go any further down the road with it because we didn't want them to start writing something and then say, oh, we don't think this is going to work. So rather than risk, you know, wasting the time of a terrific, you know, songwriter, composer, and man at the theater, we just said, we don't know how we would begin to work that into the schedule as we have to do it.
That's an incredibly, incredibly fun fact. I will say, I feel musically, I feel like I was satisfied by, you know, there's like an episode in one of the final seasons where the gang stays in a cabin and they all have weird dreams. And and so, you know, there was a Martin musical number, which I greatly enjoyed. And probably not coincidentally, I also loved when there's a much earlier episode where he, you know, tries to pitch Frank Sinatra a song. It gets rejected,
oh,
but then
such a groovy lady. Yeah.
I love that scene.
That was a wonderful episode. I wrote 3 songs for Laurie Metcalf.
Oh,
in season
really?
11, when she came back as Fred. Did you not see Caught in the Act? Caught in the Act. It's Laurie Metcalf is playing Fraser's first wife,
yes,
the children's performing agency. And Fraser won a Peter Trotson and
that's
her
right.
dad during a children's.
Yep, dressed as a baby. Yep, that's right. I remember that one. Wow.
Which is definitely the biggest humiliation. In seasons of the show. We never beat him up that badly, but he'd earned it in that one. By overcoming his scruples to jump into bed with his ex-wife, despite the fact that she was not married. And so the episode ends where she's down in the basement of the theater with a full audience of children waiting for her, and she makes her entrance on a bed that rises to the stage. And she refuses to go on because she's stricken that Fraser won't sleep with her. And then he says, you can't disappoint all those children. And she says, oh, let them learn now that life is bitter and unfair. And Fraser tears his shirt off, and he says, all right, then, all the children. And I'm on the bed. A heinous justification for, you know, rationalization for adultery I'd ever heard in my life. But it's a moment of weakness for which he's immediately punished. He doesn't get to have sex with her. That immediately starts to rise, and he's trapped on stage in a naked, you know, in the middle of
And it will
rise up to the flies by, you know, by the end of the number, leaving him trapped in the flies if he doesn't find a way to get, you know, to escape. It is the most horrible thing he did to Frasier in 11 seasons. He had humiliations that kind of took the prize.
Oh yeah, no, that visual of him with the diaper and the baby's bonnet is just truly tattooed in my brain forever. I would absolutely love to have you come back one day if you would ever come back. Would you?
I would absolutely come back.
We'll see how this one goes
and how many Twitter followers it loses you first.
I think there's going to be some very happy reactions to this episode. I really appreciate you taking the time.
I look forward to reading about it. When I do these things, I never listen to them afterwards because I wind up cringing and regretting wishing I said things. And the only way I can do them is promise myself not to listen afterwards.
Okay, you don't have to listen.
If I listened, I would never do another one.
Okay, so don't listen to it then. Do not listen to it. The next time we talk, I 100% would love to talk about Bebe, who, by the way, I want to do an entire episode just about favorite recurring characters who aren't regular characters, and she is 100% my favorite, non-regular on the show, and I could go on forever about the episode she's on where she quits smoking. That is one of my, when she does this monologue about why she loves smoking, it's just one of my favorite monologues ever. So I would love to get into her character the next time you're here.
Well, I'd be happy to talk about Bebe any day.
Great. Wonderful. Well, on that note, I want to thank Joe Keenan for coming on this show. And I'm so happy for him to hear me end this show with the name of the final episode of Frasier that he wrote. Good night, Seattle.